Don't waste time on emotions that don't do you any good.
Do I call you Lady Justice?
You can just call me Justice. Well, you tell me what a sandwich is, and then I'll tell you if a hot dog is a sandwich. When will there be enough women on the court? And my answer is, when there are nine. The two people love each other, and both are women or both are men. Why should the law put up a no sign?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 438. And it's named for the amount of votes that Gore lost by in Florida. Now, that's a deep, weird joke. Anyway, how's it going, Andrew?
I am so much happier after your deep, weird joke.
I bailed out halfway through. It didn't even really make sense.
That's okay.
I'm doing okay. Not in love with how things have developed. Your North Carolina optimism was euthanized pretty quickly right after you said it.
We're gonna talk about that.
Andrew was like, hey, maybe a good thing, and the world was like, nope,
sorry. But look, you know, we can no longer say definitively that we are in the worst possible timeline. So
oh, that's true. Yeah, we're not in the worst, unless there's some, hold on, I'll find a way. What if he loses but then takes back over by coup, which is what we're going to talk about today. So we'll have to find out if there's any chance that this is really just a fake good thing in service of a worse thing.
Fake. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. So that is the subject of today's episode. I'm sure it's on everybody's mind. As much as Andrew has told us throughout the years that, you know, there's a system and things matter, we're going to put that to the test and find out if there's a system and if things matter, according to Andrew Torres. We're also going to do a little update on the, I'm really curious, Andrew's thoughts on the Obamacare case, because the whole media decided that the justices are going to rule the way we would want them to on this, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. We'll see. Any announcements from you, sir?
Two things that I think are positive, like continuing my Optimist Prime theme. So first, we're recording this on Thursday, November the 12th, and that meant yesterday was Veterans Day, and we have a lot of veterans who are OA listeners and who are the sorts of veterans that the Trump administration declared war on. And really, really looking forward to being able to kind of recapture genuine patriotism and to be able to say to, you know, people who have put their lives on the line for our country that, you know, we hopefully have a government coming in that isn't going to use you as a prop and then, look for ways to deny you health coverage, kick you out of the military, et cetera, et cetera. So all that is a long-winded way of saying happy Veterans Day to our OA listeners who are veterans.
I want to do happy Veterans Day, but instead of symbolic stuff that does nothing, let's like give them better health care or,
yeah,
you know, yeah,
that would, do something. That would all be nice.
Do something. Let's all pool our resources and, I don't know, some form of taxation or something and put that to, we'll figure it out. Anyway, all right. And then also, hold on, big announcement. Yep. Last one was a huge hit. We've got a sequel, another No Trump Tuesday coming.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited. Thomas, you know, I argued very, very strenuously for us to do a baseball law and eminent domain this Friday. Right?
We're not there yet, man.
We're not there yet. We are not there yet. But we are at a point where, you know, if you've got friends who have needed to pause the show to get, you know, we get it. And Tuesday is going to have, it's going to have a baseball law segment. It's going to have a celebrity segment. And it is going to have a classic OA style deep dive. I'm going to make a prediction that is going to knock your socks off. So
Can't wait.
Look forward to Tuesday. It's not the happiest of predictions, but it is not a Trump
to get us excited about the fact that he's going to predict the next horrible thing to happen. Okay. So I'm excited about that. No Trump Tuesday last time worked out really well. People loved that. And I'm excited to do it again. So just think, in a few short months, could be a lot of those. Could be more of those than ever. And Andrew, quick note, just wanted to give a quick plug. I know I do it sometimes, but SIO, Serious Inquiries Only, my podcast, I just released one where I did a ton of number crunching on House races to find out whether or not progressive policy either cost us seats or won us seats. There have been a lot of claims thrown around. Spanberger was really mad about the progressives, and then AOC fought back in that New York Times interview. And I wanted to do my best to evaluate that. And so I did a lot of number crunching, came to some conclusions. If you want to hear what that is, check out Serious Inquiries 264.
Oh, what a cliffhanger. Well, I've had some access to the really in-depth work that you did on that episode. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, spoilers, AOC is probably right. But yeah
of course she's right on that. That being said, I think it's pretty intuitive that maybe the most progressive elements of the Democratic Party platform are not what you want to emphasize in a runoff election in Georgia, where Democrats ran behind, where Ossoff at least, and I think also Warnock, ran behind Joe Biden. Well, we know they ran behind Joe Biden statewide and behind the Republicans. So anyway, all of that is to say, I'm super interested for SIO 264.
Down the law, breaking down the law, breaking down the law, breaking down the law. So Andrew, yeah, the whole media at once, and maybe they're right. I can't wait to hear what you think. It was really weird. Like, multiple news flashes and headlines all seem to say well, looks like the court's gonna, uphold the Obamacare challenge, or whatever the proper phrasing would be. You'll explain to us. But is that true? What's happening here?
Here's what happened, is that we had oral arguments in California versus Texas, which is a consolidated case involving challenges to the Affordable Care Act that are it's basically two links in a chain. The first argument is that the individual mandate is now unconstitutional because in 2017, as part of the budget reconciliation process, the first year of the Trump administration reduced the tax required if you failed to purchase health insurance in accordance with the individual mandate down to zero. The Supreme Court clarified in NFIB versus Sebelius that was a tax and not just a mandate, a use of the government's general regulatory power under the Interstate Commerce Clause, which was an insane decision, which we've told you about over and over again. But in any event, so argument number one is, okay, Supreme Court in 2014 said that was a tax, but it doesn't make sense to have a tax that's zero, so that should be unconstitutional. That part of the ACA should be invalidated, declared unconstitutional. Argument number two, the second link in the chain, is what's called a non-severability argument. And it is the argument that, oh, and by the way, once you strike out the individual mandate, you have to invalidate the entirety of the ACA, right, including the provisions, and we've talked about this previously on the show, that provide for protection for pre-existing conditions. One of the most frustrating things about the presidential and vice presidential debates, as I believe I've commented here, is that Donald Trump, Mike Pence both muddied the water with an absolutely blatantly false lie of, oh, well, no, we have a plan to protect people from being discriminated against on the basis of pre-existing conditions. And, you know, we'll show it to you,
you know,
just as soon as you re-elect
us. Probably just about to release his healthcare plan. I bet it'll be, what if, that would be the ultimate practical joke. Like January 24th, he's like, got the plan. I got it. I got the plan. It's detailed. And it actually is like several binders worth. We were working on it that whole time.
Yeah. That and his taxes we'll all get on January 19th.
It's a routine audit, Andrew. It's a routine audit.
It sure is. No, so the frustrating thing is, and again, I'm not trying to, you know, Monday morning quarterback the debate performances. We did that the day after the debate. And Biden did great in the second debate. But it was frustrating to watch that lie pass through and not have Kamala Harris look over and go, Mike, all you have to do is call up Bill Barr and tell him not to show up next week in California versus Texas. You can stop this, right? We don't have to put this at risk. It's your administration that is challenging the entirety of the ACA in court. It's going to be before the Supreme Court the week after the election. Interesting timing. Right. And that would have been a nice aside, but, you know, it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And Republicans continue to lie and say, oh, yeah, no, we're absolutely for protecting pre-existing conditions. Black and white. They have argued and defended at oral argument the idea that the Supreme Court must strike down the entirety of the ACA and make everybody start over again. That's what they want. That's what they've argued. Now, what happened? We've had oral argument. And again, I want to be super clear about this. I think trying to read the tea leaves from what happens at oral arguments is a terrible, terrible, terrible idea. Right. Now, I've been wrong on that before, right? Like Andrew Seidel and I, you know, kind of went back and forth on, you know, he said, look, man, the oral argument in Trinity Lutheran went super bad. And I said, well, you know, but the law is really, really clear.
Yeah.
And he was right and I was wrong. There's that grain of salt, but we have no ruling. Here's what they're going on. And I will link, by the way, the audio and the transcripts for this Supreme Court oral argument so that, you know, if you want to listen, you can listen and make the judgment for yourself. So here's what happened. There were multiple questions from the Supreme Court's conservative wing, beginning with Chief Justice Roberts, but echoed by Justice Kavanaugh. I'm going to read those questions to you. Okay, on that second part of the prong, right, saying, are you sure that you're arguing that the entirety of the ACA is non-severable from the individual mandate, such that if we strike down the individual mandate, we have to strike down the whole law. So Roberts says, here, Congress left the rest of the law intact when it lowered the penalty to zero. That seems to be compelling evidence on the question, and invited parties to dispute that, which they did, right? I'm not going to go through and read the way in which lawyers for both sides responded to that, but they had responses to that, right? Like that's calling for a response. Robert said, and I think this is certainly correct, that I think it's hard for you to argue that Congress intended the entire act to fall if the mandate were struck down when the same Congress that lowered the penalty to zero did not even try to repeal the rest of the act, and then says, I think, frankly, they wanted the court to do that, but that's not our job. That a rare moment of candor, right? Clearly, that's what they wanted, right? The idea was they just narrowly got the tax bit passed. They lost McCain on striking down the entirety of the ACA, on not even striking down the entire, but the skinny repeal, right? And so, you know, so they had to like sneak it in, and Roberts is correctly describing those shenanigans, right? Like, we hope this will die the death of a thousand cuts. And by the way, we're going to stack the court with a bunch of right-wing judges like you, Chief Justice Roberts. We hope you'll do our job for us. So, you know, rare moment of candor.
So it sounds to me like John Roberts is going to be a really solid fourth vote in the 5-4 dissent. Cool.
I think that would be where I would bet, right? So the other statements from Kavanaugh and Thomas are, in my view, much more ambiguous, right? So Brett Kavanaugh says, quote, "It does seem fairly clear that the proper remedy would be to sever the mandate provision and leave the rest of the act in place, the provisions regarding pre-existing conditions and the rest." Brett Kavanaugh displaying all the sensitivity of somebody who's, you know, had government-sponsored health care for the last 30 years of his life. Anyway, and Clarence Thomas saying, "The individual mandate now has no enforcement mechanism, so it's really hard to determine exactly what the threat is of action against you." And those are being read as echoing Roberts. I don't think I necessarily read them that way, right? I read that as saying that the linchpin for you to win on point two is to win on non-severability, right? Which is just restating the position of the case, right? That it doesn't say we have held like this is clearly severable. It just says if this is not, if this is severable, then we can clearly craft relief. Isn't that right? And that's true. If it's severable, they can clearly craft relief, which, by the way, would still be really, really bad. And let me take a brief sidebar on that. If the Supreme Court grants prong one, 6-3, which I think they will, and declares the individual mandate unconstitutional, what that prevents Joe Biden from doing is it prevents Joe Biden with a Democratic Senate of using the budget reconciliation process in 2021 to reinstate the individual mandate. Right. Cool. It means that now you have to go back and work through the filibuster or repeal the filibuster or whatever. It throws an additional roadblock up to undo what Donald Trump did in the
first
place.
So just to make clear, they were able to undo this with that, right?
Correct.
They were able. So it'll be that you can take it away. It's a ratchet. It's a one sided ratchet.
It's a one way ratchet down, which is the exact opposite of, you know, how ratchets are supposed to work.
Cool.
It's terrible, and nobody is focusing on that, right? That this is the court stepping in and being like, okay, you move that to zero, now it's unconstitutional. And why the argument is not more persuasive of, a Republican Congress with a Republican president reduced it to zero. A Democratic Congress with a Democratic president might reinstate it. Who the hell knows, right? And the idea that the second that that you want, and again, think about this from a judicial restraint versus judicial activism perspective, the idea that you want the Supreme Court to come in and actively start minesweeping, right? Start declaring parts of statutes unconstitutional based on things that the legislature may go back and forth over is an unbelievably overbroad, overreaching activist view of the court. Buckle up because we're in for a lot of that. So
this strikes me as a pretty textualist argument. Is there a chance that Gorsuch lands on our side?
Here's the thing. All of the arguments being raised here are terrible.
Right.
We've lost all the Uncle Franks listening to the show, except that one guy who keeps changing his patron name. Good
well,
for him.
It's ever since we stole the election for Biden, it just put those, you know, well, Uncle Franks yeah. off. Sorry about enough. That. We had to
Sorry.
Manufacture
yeah, you know.
Millions of votes. You know.
Look, I do not have time in this segment. If you want, and in fact, we'll do a deconstruction when the Supreme Court strikes down at least the individual mandate and maybe the entirety of the ACA come next spring. But these arguments are embarrassingly bad. And as you are starting to calibrate, right, to what extent are any of the right-wing justices interested in the law anymore, right? Like, you know, if they're all in the 99s, right, you know, now you're trying to determine between who's the 99.1 and who's the 99.7, this is going to be a really good litmus test for this, because these arguments are virtually indefensible. And so what you're seeing, right, and this kind of brings it full circle, and then we'll, you know, move on to our main segment. That's what you saw at oral argument, right? You saw that the lead attorney for the red states that brought this suit in the first place, right? That is Texas Solicitor General Kyle Hawkins. You saw him struggle to defend the indefensible, right? because these legal arguments are so terrible. And I agree with that. He did a real bad job. These arguments are super duper bad. But I'm not convinced that his failure to articulate that is going to stop enough of the activist wing of the court. And if it does, it's going to be a roadblock only on the severability portion. And look, the argument that the individual mandate is unconstitutional is also a terrible argument. And I think we have no shot of winning on that. So that's my way of throwing some cold water on some positive headlines. And, everybody can root for me to be wrong on this. I would sure love to be wrong.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I'm not crazy for thinking it was weird that all the media decided this. And like, it looks like these right-wing hacks are going to go the right way. We've all decided. It's weird. Yep. Why did they, just because oral arguments went a certain way, they all yes. said that? Wow.
Yes. Well, that's exactly
who knows? Right. Maybe they'll be right. I guess we're rooting for them to be right.
We absolutely are.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
No, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just
Russia,
say
Russia, to a large extent, it's corrupt and it's fake. Ask the president of Finland a question, please.
Okay. Andrew, you just heard the yodeling. What, maybe for the last time? I don't know. I know we've got a lot to cover, but quick second for the sake of the show and the listeners who've been with us. We never would have thought, Andrew never would have told you, that the yodeler would only fall off the mountain January 20th, 2021, when Trump lost. That's not what we went into that thinking, is it?
Yeah, that's fair.
But that's where Yodel Mountain ended, everybody. Not with a bang, but with a Wimpa, as that the Wisconsin
right.
what was it? that was really funny meme. But we're playing that yodel music because he hasn't fallen off the mountain technically yet. So Andrew, there's a I love that I sometimes try to summarize news stories. Let me just summarize it and throw it over to you, Andrew. We're in the middle of a coup attempt of our government. What's your take on that?
Yeah, we are. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And I'm going to talk you down from the ledge, share this out with all like that. There is the same terrible, unreliable far left sources that we've been telling you to ignore leading up to the election are feeding ridiculous disinformation now that the election is over.
Okay. I mean, let me. Warrior's advocate here.
Yeah.
The president and the Republican Party, and not to mention the guy was like, yeah, we're transitioning to a second Trump administration.
Yeah, that was Pompeo, our Secretary of State. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not left-wing propaganda, Andrew. That's just things that are happening. And so I don't blame people for maybe being a little worried that there could be some problems here.
I agree with all of that. I agree with the observation as to what Donald Trump is doing. We've got this whiteboarded out a little differently, but let's stick with the top line question. Then I'm going to go through, I'm going to talk about the supporting evidence for my position, right? And the supporting evidence for my position that it's going to be fine is to go back to the doomsday scenario that which was the first time when I told you, like, maybe it's not going to be fine, right? And that was Opening Arguments, episode 425. That was the article in The Atlantic, right? What if Trump refuses to concede? And we went through and broke down not only that article, but the compelling legal arguments that underlie that article, right? So, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, but he was stitching together the legal arguments of scholars that I respect, right? And we pointed you to, in addition to that, Neil Buchanan's article, right? The really bad news about Trump's election, which he posted in June, right? And the critical aspect that made this a doomsday scenario was, what if Donald Trump is able to sow genuine doubt about the results, right? That's the key linchpin, right? And the primary data point underlying that was the blue shift analysis that we've been talking about for 2 months, right? So first and foremost, as I said in OA 425, and it is worth repeating here, like we owe a debt of gratitude to Neil Buchanan, to The Atlantic, to everybody who raised this as an issue and who smacked me upside the head and said, hey, take this seriously. We're not just talking about like Donald Trump going into a bunker and pretending like he's still the president. We are talking about active efforts to gaslight America into believing that he'd won when he lost. And here are some of the tools that we take into account. And so because of that, we were able to, and we played a tiny role in this. We were able to influence the national discussion to talk about what blue shifting means, right? Such that when Trump was ahead by 12 points in Pennsylvania and 5 points in Wisconsin in the middle of the night on Tuesday, right? The idea of, okay, well, it's over. Those states are Republican states. Trump wins. Like that none of the networks called those states. Not even Fox News ran with that narrative, right? We had successfully managed to describe the way in which votes are going to be counted. And now that's where we are today. I'm going to link in the show notes. I have shared it out of our Twitter feed. Reuters poll from yesterday, 80% of the population believes that Joe Biden won the presidency, right? So that means an overwhelming majority of people that voted for Donald Trump believe that Joe Biden won. Now, look, as people replied on our Twitter feed, if I said, is the sun hot? And it's 79%. Let's make sure I'm rounding up. And 79% said yes. And 16% said no. And 5% said, I don't know. Right. And those are the percentages, by the way, on did Joe Biden win the election? Uh-huh. Admittedly, it's terrifying that a fifth of the country does not know whether the sun is hot. Okay. We have a lot of problems. We got a lot of bad stuff going on. But the fact that Donald Trump has lost the narrative on Fox News, the fact that a majority of his supporters do not believe his claims, and as we get into the evidence, the fact that he has no clear path, even if people did, to be able to translate that in any compelling way, because he needs, right? What we saw, like what I underestimated about Trump from 2017, this is the story of the death of Yodel Mountain, right? What I underestimated about Trump in 2017 was the degree to which he was going to exercise a complete stranglehold on the Republican Party. That is going to be, we're going to spend the next 10 to 20 years piecing through the evidence on that as cowards. And make no mistake, right? Anybody, John Bolton types who were party to this and hung around and waited for Trump to lose and then came out and they are cowards. But those cowards are going to crawl out of the woodwork, and we're going to figure out what Donald Trump has on Lindsey Graham, right?
I never would have thought, like, my whole thing was like, oh, look at this. Here's what's going to happen. Trump's going to lose. And then a bunch of cowards will be like, well, I never was very happy with Trump to begin with. I never would have thought that was actually the more brave thing, that actually they would still be trying to appease him. And like, and I wonder how much of that has to do with, they want him to not just totally rage quit before the Georgia runoffs. I don't know if that's
part of the calculation. I think that's part of the calculation, but to me, I think that the main part of the calculation is, since I'm about to be super optimistic, let's be clear about what to be pessimistic about from this election, which reiterates what we said on our first post-election show, and that is this election was not a repudiation of Trumpism. Yeah. It was a validation, right? It was to say, if you run on overt racism, that then you will overperform your polls, right? That's the lesson if you're a Republican. And so all of these people are looking at it going, well, I'm going to inherit the mantle of Trumpism, right? I'm going to get all of his QAnon loving supporters, and they're going to back me next time, and I'm going to be unstoppable. And that's, you know, that's terrifying. And we're going to have to be, we're going to have to fight this battle continuously. The first step in that battle, we're going to talk about this more in the C segment, is winning back the Senate, is beating Trump supporters in Georgia in a runoff election. So, you know, that's where I'm putting 100% of my political initiatives, and energy, for the next 7 weeks. It's where I would encourage you to do that as well. So to get there, let me tell you why. So that's my overarching case, right? The overarching case is the case for a Trump coup was based on a lot of different things, clicking into place, but the fundamental top line was, being able to argue with a straight face that the election results are ambiguous. And Trump's lost that. His arguments that the election is ambiguous or that he won, they are preposterously terrible arguments right now. And every time you make those preposterously terrible arguments, somebody who's 35, who's got to carry them out, is sitting there going, I'd like to be governor of Pennsylvania someday. And if I perjure myself in open court in support of this nonsense that isn't going to work anyway, I'm not going to get there. And so I'm not going to do that. And that's right. So, you know, what made Trumpism possible was a complete co-optation of the mechanisms of power of every Republican all the way down to, you know, your 18 and 19 year old staffers. What's making it impossible right now is that same institutional process, right? It's the, and I know not enough rats have left a ship that is not just sinking, but, you know, those Trump boats, you know, as that we saw from the parade, right? Like, they are underwater, they are crashed, they are destroyed. It's ridiculous. We should be seeing more rats. We're not.
Yeah, we're seeing a bunch of rats who are like, no, the ship is fine, not sinking. It actually is higher above the water than ever.
Yep.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Hims. You've heard us talking about Hims and how they're helping guys look their best, but if you haven't yet, it's time to see what they're all about. Did you know that 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35? And once you've noticed that thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. So why do guys turn to weird solutions or do nothing when they can turn to medicine and science? I think recent events in the world have shown us that turning to medicine and science is a lot better than doing nothing. Just saying. That's where 4hims.com comes in. It's your one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and sexual wellness for men. Hims is helping guys be the best versions of themselves with licensed medical providers and FDA-approved products to help treat hair loss. This is not snake oil pills or gas station supplements. These are prescription solutions backed by science. Hims was created by a guy who knows that some men's health conversations are easier online than in person. So no more awkward in-person doctor's visits where you got to tell several different people what's wrong with you and it's kind of weird and you don't want to do it. 4hims connects you to licensed medical professionals online, which could save hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. Just answer a few quick questions and a medical professional will review. And if they determine it's right for you, they can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Today, Hims is giving you their best offer yet. If you're not happy with your results after 90 days, Hims will give you a full refund. And right now, our listeners can get their first visit absolutely free. Go to 4hims.com/OA. That's forhims.com/OA. Full refund of price paid available for first 90 days supply. Refund request must be made between 90 and 180 days after product shipment delivered. Prescription products require an online consultation with a medical professional who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and safety information. One more time, that is 4hims.com/OA.
Let's talk about the lawsuits and the Supreme Court. Again, I think that this is important to emphasize because hopefully people will share this out with people who haven't been with us for 439 episodes. The Supreme Court isn't magic, right? In order to award relief, the Supreme Court must have before it a justiciable case or controversy, right? And courts don't decide, they don't issue advisory opinions, they don't decide questions in the abstract. All of that is to say, you cannot just file a letter with the Supreme Court that says, I want you to make me the president. Now, George W. Bush did that, but he was able to do that because he had a case that could award him that relief, right? Yeah. He had the Supreme Court of Florida said, we're going to award recounts in these three counties. And George Bush's legal team looked at that and said, gosh, if they do that, I'm probably going to lose Florida and therefore the election. So I'm going to go to the Supreme Court and I'm going to ask them for a thing that the court can do. Right. And
yeah.
Something the court can do is tell a state Supreme Court that it's violating the Constitution. Now, go listen to Opening Arguments, episodes 1-4, if you haven't. That decision was a travesty, was politically motivated, was by its own terms not to ever be cited as precedent for anything ever. Right. Like
yeah.
It was very clear, you know, the Supreme Court split 5-4 and not Democratic and Republican appointees because David Souter sided with the liberals. But politically, despite the fact that David Souter was a George H.W. Bush appointee. So that's a rough one, right? Like,
yeah.
Thanks to your dad for putting me on the court, but George W. Bush.
Oh, but that's wow. What if that's awesome? He has some dignity, yeah. Didn't want to yeah. steal an election for somebody. That's cool.
Yes, I agree. We could use a lot more Souters these days. So the Supreme Court could award the election to George W. Bush in 2000 because it had the power to do the thing that it was being asked to
right.
do. The cases that are being teed up right now are so bad that there's nothing that the Supreme Court can do. I'm going to take the best one. Okay. And I looked at 11 separate court decisions in preparation for today's decision for today's show. I picked the one that has not instantly been dismissed, although that I checked it right before we started recording. That decision is expected to come out as we are recording this episode. So this will probably be dismissed by the time I'm telling you about it. But it's still illustrative. This is their best case, and their best case is a total loser, okay? And is a total loser all the way up to Amy Coney Barrett. Here's why. This case is called Trump versus Montgomery County. It is filed in the Court of Common Pleas of Pennsylvania, the state trial court. I'm going to upload into the show. I've already uploaded on our website. It'll be listed in the show notes. The transcript, you can read this transcript, and I'm going to quote from it in some places, but you will see just how bad these arguments are. Trump is going to lose this lawsuit as he has lost every single lawsuit.
Oh,
that
yeah,
he has
but
filed.
There was one where they said the poll watchers could get a little closer that one
yep.
time. So then,
yep.
therefore, he's won one and has a case, right?
Yeah.
I've seen that
yeah.
argument made.
That's a great argument. he's lost again. Like the completion of the sentence. Every lawsuit he has brought challenging particular ballots, seeking relief to get counting stopped or to get counting restarted, to throw ballots out, to count other ballots. He's lost every single one of those.
Hmm.
Yes, he won a case in Pennsylvania that allowed his howler monkeys to get closer to people in a pandemic and spit on them. And I wish he'd lost that one too, right? Because I kind of would like for us not to have an outbreak of COVID among poll workers, but whatever, fine.
Now, I'm not a lawyer. Is 0 for 11 good in legal terms? Or
it's
is that
not. It's really not that great.
Not good. Okay.
So, what's at issue in Trump versus Montgomery County? Donald J. Trump has challenged 592 ballots. Okay. I want to put this into context for you. Montgomery County, Pennsylvania received over 500,000 votes cast. It split 60-40 for Biden. That was a 130,000 vote margin. Roughly half of those were votes by mail, almost 250,000 votes cast by mail. Of those 250, that's 243,692 as of this recording. Right? Of those 250,000 votes by mail, Donald Trump's legal team has found 592 that they wish to challenge. That is, if you are good at math, less than 0.25%.
Yeah.
Here's what they have challenged. These are being challenged due to various technical defects on the ballot. Okay. And not even on the ballot, on the envelope that the ballot was put in. So in Pennsylvania, different counties did different ways, but basically they mailed you your mail-in ballot. You fill out the ballot, you fold it up, you put it in, and then you put it in the special envelope. The envelope has a declaration on the back. The declaration says, I am authorized to vote in the state of Pennsylvania, and I certify by mailing this that I have not voted in person. Okay? I'm not voting twice. Then, although the ballot came to your address, you are also, there's a line for you to write your address and sign it and date it. Okay? And these are ballots that are either missing in whole or in part some of that information, right? And you, and for the most part, it is people who failed to copy all of their address number for number, you know, line for line, that was already listed on the ballot, over onto the declaration form. Okay. So this is what we're talking about. We are talking about, you know, comes to your house at 123 Fake Street, Sacramento, California, you know, 97655.
Come on. Wow. Okay.
And you write 123 Fake Sacramento, California, and you don't put in the zip code. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
That level of harmless
defect. Therefore,
defect.
You shouldn't have the right to vote. Seems totally not evil to me.
So you're thinking, oh, okay, surely I am parodying their argument. I want to read you from page 14.
I wasn't, but yeah. One could be thinking that, I
One
guess.
Could think that. Donald Trump's lawyer, page 14, read it for yourself. When the court says, so you're really saying because it might not match up on the address, you want me to throw all these votes out? And his lawyer says, yeah, yes, we want you to throw all these votes out. And then he adds, quote, certainly, if the court is going to deny my motion in its entirety on that basis, okay, which by the way, like never a great sign when you're 5 minutes into oral argument and you're like, look, I'm probably going to lose. So don't throw out everything. You could just throw out a subset of what I'm going to lose on. I'm actually going to read a little bit beforehand. The court. So your answer is that all 592 ballots should be invalidated? Mr. Goldstein, that's Trump's lawyer. Correct. Yes, Your Honor. The court. And there should not be a separate analysis for the subsets of different types of irregularities that may exist on some ballots? Mr. Goldstein. Certainly, if the court is going to deny my motion in its entirety on that basis, I would look for perhaps smaller subset that this court might find it appropriate to strike. If you were to say, for example, I am not striking these on the basis that an address is missing, I would want the opportunity to strike the ones where the date is missing or wrong, right?
Yeah.
Or somebody wrote, for example, their birth date where the signature is missing or, you know, illegible, things like that. Right. And so that's the Trump campaign's argument. If you screwed up in any way on the ballot, your vote should not count in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. And why shouldn't it count in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania? Because it went 60-40 for Joe Biden. That's their argument. But fortunately, their view of the law is terrible and wrong, and they have no chance in hell of winning on this argument. Right. So the law, what's it say? 25 Pennsylvania Statute 3150.16 says, after you receive your mail-in ballot, quote, the elector shall then fill out, date, and sign the declaration printed on such envelope, end of quote. And then it goes to, this is 3150.14, form of declaration. That declaration must contain a statement of the elector's qualifications, right? That is, that they're eligible to vote, together with a statement that the elector has not already voted in the primary or election. Those are the only things that are required by law for the voter to fill out, right? I certify that I have not voted in the election and that I am eligible to vote in this election. And then it's up to, this is 3146.8G3, quote, if the county board has verified the proof of identification as required under this act, right? That is, they've matched it with the barcode. and is satisfied that the declaration is sufficient, then the vote counts. Right. So in other words, it's up to the board of canvassers to look at it and go, did this guy fill out his declaration? Okay. Looks like he did. Yeah. Did he put 11-4 when he should have put 11-2? Right. Whatever. Like,
yeah. There's some chance that meant he was voting in a different election on a different day.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's like when you write, 2019 on your check.
Yeah.
This is such a bad argument. That this is how, I'm going to go back to now page 5 to 6. This is what their lawyer has to say, right? This is it. So no citation to any authority whatsoever. No citation to the law other than this. In terms of the substantive argument, the mail-in balloting, the statute 25 PS 3150.16A, that's what I just read to you, says in pertinent part, the elector shall then fill out, date, and sign the declaration. The court has before it a narrow question. Does fill out mean anything other than what its plain language calls for? And do we need to look anywhere else to find out what fill out means? I submit we do not need to look elsewhere. The meaning of the language is self-evident. If a doctor's office hands you a form and tells you to fill it out, and you hand it back with blanks, they will tell you, you didn't fill it out. Go finish it. Fill it out means just that. That is the Trump administration's argument to throw out ballots in Pennsylvania. It is, well, fill out means fill out all of it. And if you screwed up any part, we get to throw your ballot in an incinerator. And by the way, don't look at any of the other laws, because you should go by my folksy analogy from the doctor telling you to fill out the form as opposed to, what the law actually tells you to do. So they're going to lose on that. But the delightful part is, even if the Trump administration were correct, right, that yeah. fill out means fill out in its entirety, right, the question would then be for the court, what's the remedy you get, right? And the remedy you get when a voter screws up part of the ballot is not, we pretend like that voter has been vaporized from space by a giant laser, right? The remedy you get is appropriate to redress the wrong.
So, right? Like, does the voter get to, like, fix the date on the ballot?
That's right. Like, it, and here, again, I know
this is a crack legal team, Andrew. Wow.
This is amazing. I'm going to quote you from, and by the way, these are all the arguments I'm making are arguments that were made by the state of Pennsylvania, right? Like, this is, I wish I could take credit for coming up with the legal analysis that dismantles this, but like, it's already been done, right?
Yeah.
And so this is why I am 100% confident that as we record this, that relief is going to be denied. State of Pennsylvania replied with, yeah, only problem with this is that it's been clear for 50 years in the state of Pennsylvania that these kinds of technical errors don't mean you throw out the ballot.
Right.
And that comes from a case called In Re Recount of Ballots from 1974. And it comes from a 1973 judicial election for the Beaver County Court of Common Pleas, which is a state trial court in Beaver County in western Pennsylvania. It's a Pittsburgh suburb. And by the way, these are the kinds of cases in which recounts matter. This involved Republican Robert C. Reed was trailing the Democrat Joseph S. Walco. Then after opening up a whole bunch of ballots, Reed went ahead 30,598 to 30,591. Right. So look, like when you lead by 7 ballots,
yeah,
recounts matter, right? Like you look at every single, ballot that's out there. And as it turns out, right, Walco won on election night, but after the recount, Reed won. So, right. So yeah, 7 votes you can overturn. Trump is down by 54,000 votes in Pennsylvania. A recount has never overturned 54,000 votes.
It'd be funny if
votes.
The court was like, sure, we'll just give you. You can have them. In fact, take 2-for-1 deal. Take 1,000 votes. Yeah,
take 2. They're small. Yeah.
Just we'll give it. Just credit. Just for fine. On us. It's on. It's on the house. 1,000 ballots. Okay. Are we done here? Are we done? Can we end this?
Yeah, well, and,
election
and
look, madness.
The fact that the courts aren't doing that is part of what underscores my larger point, which is that courts can only rule on the questions that are before it, right? Like, they have to pretend to take this seriously.
Well, okay, here's what I was worried about. They come up with some, you know, something better than this 512 ballot nonsense crap. We all know it's still nonsense crap, but it gets, you know, killed going up the chain of appeal all the way until the hack Supreme Court, who says, yeah, up is down. We rule in favor of you. That's what I think I and other people were a little worried might happen. But are you saying there's just no physical way for that to actually happen?
Yeah, I'm saying that, like, those lawsuits have to get filed, right? Like, that's certainly what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. But there is – so there's a rule in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. It is Rule 11, right? And you've heard me mention it before. Yeah. States have their own equivalent. When you have a lawyer, even a terrible, bad, awful lawyer, that they will think twice – before they will file something that they know is legally and factually false, because you can be sanctioned, you can be disbarred, and courts are, again, it's super rare. But like I said, I've won sanctions arguments in court, right? It's not that rare, right? When lawyers engage in substantive misconduct.
Well, somehow Larry Klayman is still a lawyer, though.
So I get it. And Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani. But that's what they're up against, right? Is even finding these bottom tier lawyers. And we're going to talk about the controversy over Jones Day and some of the other big law firms that are bailing on Donald Trump. Jones Day is not going to submit a pleading that it knows is false on its face. That would be disastrously bad because that would adversely affect its malpractice insurance. And they have 85,000 lawyers. That's an exaggeration. They have thousands of lawyers, right? Like, Jones Day has thousands of lawyers worldwide. And so, yeah, if they double their malpractice insurance because a court sanctions one of their lawyers for filing a patently false declaration in court, yeah, that could cost them tens of millions
saved
of
by
dollars.
Insurance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who would have thought? Okay?
So, the way to unpack all of what you've said is, yes, I share with you the fear in the abstract of bunch of you need bullshit lawsuits in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia. And then you need, like, for them to all go up and somehow all get in front of the Supreme Court, and for the Supreme Court in five successive cases to come in and intervene and grant sufficient relief to overturn the results. And what I'm telling you is they're trying to do that and they can't. They can't because there's a limit, right? Like, there's no limit to what you can say to QAnon believers, right? You can tell them to go to the basement of a pizza parlor that doesn't have a basement. You can't say that in a court pleading. And we've seen this time and time again. I cut from the show because, you know, you've seen where CNN, MSNBC, you know, have read from the, are you alleging there's any fraud with these ballots? Trump lawyer, no, Your Honor. Well, then we're done here, aren't we? Right. Yeah. Like, it is. So this is what they're left with. They're left with things like 592 ballots where, you know, they got the date wrong or they didn't copy over their address properly move through just completing the end of that recount case because it really is illustrative. In the recount case, again, remember, this is a 1973 election, right? Your ballot back then had a little tiny perforated square in the corner that was the number of the ballot. And it was how they protected against fraud in handing out ballots at the polling places, right? So Thomas Smith goes in, they check you off. They say, oh, you get ballot number 293. And then they hand you ballot number 293. And then they tell you, hey, before you put that in the box, tear off the little 293 in the corner, right? That way your ballot will remain anonymous. Make sense?
Okay.
And there were a dozen ballots in this race. Again, you know, 62,000 votes cast. There were a dozen people that put their ballot in the box and didn't tear off the little perforated thingy, right? And as you might imagine, the candidate who was ahead was like, hey, don't go count those ballots. And the candidate who was behind was like, yes, go count those ballots.
Oh, they didn't get counted.
Right.
They didn't get counted at the
they were like, nope, those are invalid votes. We're not going to count them. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was like, that's stupid, guys.
Yeah.
And they didn't quite say it that way. Here's what they said. Clearly, the invalidation of a ballot where the voter has complied with all instructions communicated to him and in the absence of any improper influence having been exerted, invalidation would necessarily amount to an unreasonable encroachment upon the franchise, and the legislative enactment should not be interpreted to require such a result. To rule otherwise would unnecessarily condition the right to vote upon the proper discharge of the responsibility of an election official over whom the voter has no control. So let's unpack that a little bit. Those 12 voters said, yeah, I didn't tear off a little thing in the corner because nobody told me to. Right. There was no evidence, any other, but it was just like, right, I wasn't told to tear off the corner. And they're like, yeah, well, sorry, you got to tear off the corner. And so they said, look, if you tried to vote in good faith, if you did everything you could, if the instructions were reasonable, you know what? Go back, tear off the corner now so that these people can remain anonymous, but we're going to count your votes. And that's what they did. And they counted the votes. The votes got added to Robert C. Reed. That's the Republican, by the way. And he became a judge. Joseph S. Waldo became nothing, right?
Flipped the election? It flipped it? Just those?
It flipped the election.
Holy
on the results
moly.
Of counting the little perforated ballots. And so today, yeah, you can look up. I did in prep for the show. Robert C. Reed. He does not have a Wikipedia page. He does have a Ballotpedia page.
Does he have an IMDb
Joseph S. Waldo
page?
Is, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, no, I don't, but you do. That seems fair. Joseph S. Waldo became nothing. That's fine, right? Like, I'm glad that happened. Reed got more votes. He should have won. Good on him. And that's what the court's going to say here. That's what the court's saying in all of these cases. And you don't need to be worried that the Supreme Court is going to come in and craft some kind of crazy new, it's just, they're not being set up in that. It's not going to happen. And as with Bush v. Gore, right, the clock's ticking, right? So, you know, you don't have an indefinite amount of time to try and concoct something. It's over. We're out of time for this segment. So we're going to have to do at some other time the instruction from Bill Barr to the Assistant Attorneys General for the Criminal Division, Civil Rights Division, National Security Division, instructing them to go out and prosecute election fraud that led to the resignation of the chief of the Election Fraud Division, Richard Pilger. I will just tell you, I will link it in the show notes. This is another indication of the overarching theme here, which is that the system is working, right? What Barr did was unconscionable. It's in violation of DOJ guidelines, but you knew that already. And it doesn't matter. What it does is it authorizes investigations where those investigations should not be authorized.
I want to say the system isn't working. We're a plane where one of the engines is gone. Part of the wing got, I don't know, eaten by something. And we try to do the landing gear. Oh, that's not sticking. But then Solly Sullenberger is like, well, we can still maybe land and not kill everybody on board, possibly. And then we do that. And then Andrew's like, see, plane works fine.
fair. Well, our Sully Sullenberger here is Richard Pilger, who, and again, it will be linked in the show notes, literally wrote the book here. The book in this case is called Federal Prosecution of Election Offenses, 8th Edition. He wrote that.
Cool.
This outlines, you will see references to what is called the 60-day policy. It is page 84 of Pilger's book. And it says, overt criminal investigative measures should not ordinarily be taken in matters involving alleged fraud in the matter in the manner in which votes were cast or counted until the election in question has been concluded, its results certified, and all recounts and election contests concluded. End of quote. I had more I could go on, but yes, it says that you do not bring criminal charges until an election is over, because we can wait, right? Like, okay, sure. Somebody stole an election. We absolutely want to prosecute that guy. Let's not cast doubt on the veracity of legal votes. Let's not undermine democracy. Yeah, it makes total sense. It's been government policy since ever, and Bill Barr doesn't care. So it's bad to rescind that. And again, it wasn't rescinded. It was just a memo that is contrary to that. But I talked to three separate people at the Department of Justice. I actually had a copy of Pilger's email before Vanita Gupta managed to leak it. I was really hoping to break news on the show with it. It went to 250 people, so I'm not surprised it got out to somebody else. But one of my contacts at DOJ said, "Hey, I can get this memo to you. I gotta like take a screenshot and send it for my other account."
And, here.
Yeah, it was super cool. I was very, very excited to share it with you. But look, the bottom line is, this says, okay, I will entertain if you want to start bringing criminal charge, but like, there aren't facts to support that, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, can I rule out that one of Bill Barr's henchmen doesn't try and do something in the next 3 weeks? I can't rule it out. But I can tell you that this is the desperate last set of plays from somebody that couldn't manage to book the four seasons. Like, you're fine. It's all going
to
be fine.
It finally made an appearance on the show. Four seasons. We hadn't even touched on it. It's been done to death, but oh my God, it's the best possible ending.
It's the best thing ever. Best way
for this administration to go out. Couldn't be better. I cannot wait. When I'm 70, I'll be watching documentaries on this horrible time, and that I'll just be waiting for that part. I'll be like, I'll have my grandkids like, just wait. It gets better. You have no idea how this is going to end. It's incredible. According to Andrew, to sum all this up, it's going to be fine.
It's fine.
He's that dog with the whole thing on fire, and he says it's going to be fine. We'll see. But
you've seen the meme of the firefighter rescuing that dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Andrew and us, I guess. Yeah. Now they think.
That's us.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons. Patreon.com/law. By the way, Law Dogs, new Law Awful movies coming at you very fast. We're excited for it. It's going to be something that's a lot more cheerful to do in the wake of this election. Can't wait.
Oh, we have good stuff planned. And I want to continue to plug away. Every week now, I am including Miss Ashley's extra stories in the news. I've got 8 full pages of notes and links that didn't make the show that, you know, if you're a patron to our show, like, you will appreciate the curated election research stories, funny stuff. It's fantastic. Ashley does an amazing job on that. And we give that away to every single patron. So I'm going to continue that every week, so long as, until Ashley goes insane. So it'll be great.
Well, why don't you thank our new patrons over at patreon.com/law?
Thank you to Sparkle Donkey Tequila, the world's best tequila in the world. I love that. At sparkledonkey.com. Okay. I got to tell you, I'm going to have to open up a private window just to make sure that we're not being punked on sparkledonkey.com.
Even if we are, who cares?
Yeah. I do love some tequila, so I will check that out. That's drink of choice of our ace associate Morgan Stringer. So there we go. Derek Maxwell, Tim Nitrauer. Thanks to I voted Jorgensen in Georgia, but I still like the podcast. Yeah, no thanks to you. Seriously, you can
you were a Trump supporter who voted Jorgensen, then you're a genius. We love you.
Fair.
Great job.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. But if you were going to vote against Trump, if you were going to vote for Biden and you voted for Jorgensen in Georgia,
you're dead to us.
We will fight you. We will knife fight you. Next, Rex Kramer, thank you. Thanks to dreadfully awaiting Georgia effing up this runoff, still voting for Ossoff and Warnock. We are going to talk to you a lot over the next couple of weeks about what to do in Georgia. That's the battle lines now. So hopefully we talked you off the ledge this week, and now we're going to talk about how you can be productive and how we can win back the Senate. thanks to Fun Run 92, to Dad Jokes PhD. I love dad jokes. And we're all dads here. Thanks to Crimson Ghost, Tim O'Connor, and thanks to Sakis Efthymiadis. And I apologize if I have mispronounced what I believe is a Greek name there, but Sakis, thank you so much for supporting the show.
And thank you to Stephen or Stefan, not sure which. Oh yeah, I almost forgot, we're doing a socially distanced live show in Philly. if we could get Gritty, I'll do it. If Gritty will come join us, I'll, it's worth it. I'll get COVID. It's worth it. Dan Miles, Jose A. Perez, Watch Trump, now showing at your local courthouse. Jerry Bonner, Tyler Lukasiewicz, Purple Kitty of Doom, Thomas Collins, and Alex Poole. Thanks so much for pledging.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. See if I can go on a two-question stretch. I don't remember. Anyway, let's see if I can answer this one right.
Maybe our shortest question ever on T3BE. Wow. So here you go. A cyclist sued a defendant corporation for injuries sustained when she was hit by a truck owned by the defendant and driven by its employee who was making deliveries for the defendant.
Oh, wow. Too real.
The day after the accident, the employee visited the cyclist in the hospital and said, I'm sorry for what
hearsay.
I did. At trial, the employee testified that he exercised due care. Why is the cyclist's testimony relating what the defendant employee said at the hospital admissible to prove negligence? Right? So it is admissible. Why?
Okay.
A.
First thing that jumps to my mind is statement against interest. We'll see.
A. It is a prior inconsistent statement. B. It is a statement against interest.
Okay. Okay.
C. It is a statement by a party opponent's agent, or D, it is a statement of a then existing state of mind.
Oh, I hate hearsay so much. I assume that's ultimately what this comes down to. Okay, cyclist, we got the facts here. Amazon has got it.
Yeah.
It's all too real. And then unfortunately, I know Amazon always gets away with it. So I can't let that pollute my legal opinion here. But anyway, Amazon has a delivery truck and they make a poor worker not making enough money drive to make deliveries at a rapid pace that's not achievable by humans. And so that poor tired person hits somebody. And then day after the accident, the poor tired employee, because they actually have a heart unlike the Amazon corporation, visits and says, I'm so sorry for what I did. And then at trial, the employee, though, has had to testify that he exercised due care. So it says, why is the cyclist testimony? So the cyclist is getting to testify to what the defendant said at the hospital. Like I said, my gut instinct was statement against interest, but all these look a little bit plausible, you know. So A, it is a prior inconsistent statement. I mean, that's possible. I mean, it is that. Is that a hearsay exception? Is that a hearsay exception that somehow like takes precedence over the one I thought it was? Or B, which is B, it is a statement against interest. Could be that. C, it is a statement by a party opponent's agent. I mean, all this could be all this stuff. I mean, the only complication I could see here is that the cyclist is suing the corporation and then the defendant employee is the one that said the thing. So maybe that means like C, it's a statement by a party opponent's agent is better. Ah, man, I hate hearsay. D, it is a statement of a then existing state of mind. That, I don't know. That doesn't seem great. I think I've narrowed it down to B or C. I think it's either statement against interest, which was my first instinct, probably what I should go with, or C, statement by a party opponent's agent. So if C were correct, it's a statement by a party opponent's agent. That seems to suggest that any statement by a party opponent's agent could be admissible in this way, no matter what they were saying. And I think that's enough for me to just go with my first instinct, which was B, it's a statement against interest. That's what I'm going with. Final answer. We'll see if I'm right.
And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share it this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your answer, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And that's our show. Oh, thanks for the breakdown, Andrew. I know you didn't get to even half of what you wanted to, but hey, those patrons get that newsletter, get the notes, extra stuff, and we'll find a way to squeeze it in later. See you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law-talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.